Hello and welcome once again to Lichtman and Rizzo Live, in air quotes at Grassroots Tavern. As always, I'm John Lichtman, contributor to the house next door and wonderful, wonderful creator of National Treasure 3, The Book of Secrets Part 2. I don't know. Joined disapprovingly by Vadim Rizzo.
I still don't know what I'm doing here.
And edited, curated, and moderated by Keith Rulick, editor of the house next door.
Thank you, John.
And you're already on your second drink, so no more.
Yes, that I bought myself, which is a rare occurrence. Blondie!
Okay, anyway. Our special guests for this episode are Canadian.
Have flown 11 hours to be here.
They haven't flown, they came by bus.
Whatever. It's a first.
We're low-tech in Canada.
Yeah. In Canada, everyone rides polar bears. And they go way down here. I'm convinced.
Polar bear got really tired 4 hours in.
We can switch it out at Buffalo, you know.
But we have Adam and Andrew of CinemaScope.
Adam Naiman.
Say hi.
Hey, how you doing?
And Andrew Tracy.
Hello.
You just bear with last names. Go figure.
Crack
operation.
I just
want to be sure they get credit where credit is due. Unlike some other podcast sites. Anyway.
Hey, don't say that about Manolo Dargis.
Aww. Leave Manolo alone.
Well, I think the first thing we should get on, because we have two wonderful big fans of Guy Madden here.
That's not entirely untrue, but...
Yeah, really?
But, you know, Andrew wrote a... piece for Reverse Shot that proved slightly contentious, which I thought was funny because, you know, I guess contentiousness is comes like with writing a nuanced piece that attempts to take middle ground rather than just this sort of scorched earth, you know, he's great or he's a hack. But I can leave that to Andrew to talk about, I guess.
Well, I don't know. I don't know anything about Guy Madden's reputation down in New York except that everybody loves him.
He's a golden god.
Yes, this is it.
Well, he's like the golden god who's on acid when he screams, "I'm a golden god," so people actually believe
Wasn't
it.
That Jason Lee?
It's not true. Jason Lee? Was it Jason Lee?
No,
it's Billy. I believe Billy Crudup. The late lamented Billy Crudup, or may as well have been.
I believe you had the biggest reaction to the piece, so why don't you explain the New York reputation of Guy Madden?
I don't know about the New York reputation. I just got really tired. You know, I went and I watched, I saw Careful, and I've seen Dracula, Pages of a Virgin's Diary. I may or may not force myself to watch my Winnipeg because I hear it's a step up, but I just got really, like, I don't know of any other guy who's just recycled himself so often and done this thing, and I'm glad that the scratches look real, congrats, and, you know, good job with the spread of footage, dude, it looks authentic, but, you know, Heart of the World is about 13 phallus jokes, which is about right for a 7-minute short, but not necessarily something to build an entire career out of this retro anachronistic, plus, you know, undercurrents of sexuality suddenly bubbling out, you know. Like that little column he writes in Film Comment, where he demonstrates a greater command of the cinematic hand than I'll ever have, but still finds time to say that he likes Elf just to make people like me angry. I mean, that's nice and everything. He seems like an interesting guy, but I'm really tired of this shtick, man. You got to get over it.
See, if Andrew had written that, I could understand people would be upset.
But so when you wrote a far more reasonable version, I just when I read it, I actually skimmed over the reasonable parts and just went to the juggler.
That's all right.
And then I read it again, and it's like, well,
not quite vicious enough.
Not vicious.
It's our placid Canadian temperament. That's which spawned Guy Madden, of course.
All New Yorkers stand around with bulging veins, talking all the time.
Well, the placid Canadian temperament may be why Madden stands out, because, you know, style is anathema to a lot of contemporary Canadian films. So Madden, whose films are abundant stylistically, sometimes too much so, as you're saying. You know, Heart of the World, we've talked about both of us. I mean, it's our favorite of his films because it's so short and it's so concentrated and it doesn't have a chance to become too exhausting. But that said, and as you said in your piece, My Winnipeg's a perfectly funny, enjoyable movie. And as a statement of civic pride in a country that sort of tends to regard cities and small towns just as locuses of disappointment and sadness and whatever else, you know, I mean, My Winnipeg is the most affirmative movie ever made about a Canadian provincial capital. You know, we just had a film that that came out called This Beautiful City, which is terrible. That should be the title of My Winnipeg. The title of This Beautiful City should be Let's All Hate Toronto, which is another documentary that just played. I mean, I don't think it's right to hate on Guy Madden, but I think, you know, asking questions of why the same shtick continues to appeal to people who keep finding new stuff in it, you know, when it really is the same, I think you're right. It hasn't changed appreciably as far as I can tell.
But what you're saying, Adam, is that, and Andrew, maybe you can speak this as well, is that people have taken it as harsher than it was really written. So why do you, I mean, it seems like you, what Adam was saying, like the reaction to it has been like, oh, he hates him or something like that. You know, they're reading the nuance as more I don't know, vitriolic. Why do you think that is?
I think it's just a pretty typical reaction. You got to go to either pole when you're talking about these things. You hate them or you love them. It's either way, and there's no in between. But I think, frankly, Guy Madden is all about in between. I mean, there's nothing in his work. Sorry.
No, I'm
there's,
sorry.
There's nothing in it. There's nothing in his work that could lead to greater development. You know what I mean? There's nothing there. It's the same tricks all the time. He gets more personal. And actually, I think, you know, it's kind of funny in My Winnipeg, which most of us have seen, I guess, to see him bringing his own voice up to the front, which I think I called his endearingly inadequate voice. Because that's the thing. He doesn't seem in person to equal the grand, you know, the fake grand fantasies and grand passions he brings up in the films. But actually, I don't find anything kind of disingenuous about that. I think he's constantly, he's consciously being artificial. He's a conscious artificer, but in a very honest kind of way. I don't see anything wrong with that. I just see a problem with acclaiming this as the height of something. I think I called it something like boutique cinema. That's what it is. It's a precious little object. Objet d'art, you can put it on your table and look at it and fawn over it and put it away, and then you're finished. And that's okay, as long as we don't say too much about it or build it up.
Well, what was interesting about My Winnipeg, I mean, you mentioned this last year at TIFF, it kind of was like the default hit of the festival among a lot of critics who we know.
That's very true.
Because it's very easy to like, and because, as you say, in order to like it, all you really have to do is inventory what happens in it. You're like, oh, there are these frozen horse heads, and that was really funny, which it is. And because of that, there weren't any big ideological divides about that movie. People were having fights about some of the other movies there, in some cases better movies, and in some cases worse movies. But My Winnipeg just kind of skated right over the top. I mean, I didn't talk to anyone at TIFF, journalists from all over the place, who didn't ultimately like that movie.
Yeah.
Did you feel, I'm thinking actually of a comparable piece of yours, Andrew, which was the No Country for Old Men piece.
That was comparable.
Well, I think so because I think it too essentially is looking at it from a perspective where it's not hating on it, but it's not proclaiming it the greatest thing since sliced bread either, but that seems to spark something in people. And I mean, I find that sort of an interesting thing. You know, I think this is something interesting we're getting into, which is sort of like the strain and criticism meaning to be on one side or the other, rather than kind of exploring through a sort of more centrist is the wrong word. But do you know what I mean? Like more, you know.
You know what? I mean, a lot of critics and writers I talk to have far more nuanced opinions in person than they do in print. And I think that it's something that people either consciously or unconsciously find themselves doing. It's pushing themselves towards the extremes in their reaction. Because, I mean, I've done it, and I'm sure everybody here has done it at some point as well.
I've had it done to me by editors, too, which is actually, like, not something I can complain about too much. But, we found, when I tend to write ambivalent things, they tend to get a little more beefed up in one direction or another, which is... You know, I need the attention, so, I guess that's cool, but it definitely happens.
Right.
Because of my reaction to pretty much everything, especially things like an assign that I just do for money, which is a lot, tends to be very ambivalent, because what's the point on hating in something tiny and insignificant and poorly budgeted and poorly marketed, but at the same time?
That's kind of a frightening concept to take with writing. Are you saying that unless an editor pushes you, you don't care about a paper?
No, like if you see like some like tiny, well-meaning documentary with its heart in the right place, whose filmmaker's street visuals is an unfortunate distraction from their agenda, well, there's nothing really to say about that. And it tend to either
What you just said, which stretched to 200 words, would be fine.
Exactly, and I don't want to convey the impression that that's all I do, because sometimes I write about movies that I care about, but a lot of the time you're just grinding through, and someone has to watch every movie that comes out, and I write for one of the only two papers in the city that actually does that, so.
Yeah, this is my job, too. I mean, our magazine in Toronto covers every single thing that comes out, so when you're talking about those sort of movies that are small, and it's not really point-taking a big position on one way or the other, I know exactly what you feel. And also with documentaries, I find most reservation. I mean, if I ever have to write another review where I say conventional talking head structure again, I get sick.
Oh, I stopped doing it. I just started offering like plot summaries and figuring out like who the market for this is and what their political sympathies are and if it would serve them. Because there was no point. A bunch of tiny, a bunch of African children weeping over Enya music. And like, I don't mean that to disparage either.
Oh, you saw War Dance.
No, I saw a different one that I'm not even going to name because I actually got blurbed on it, which was surprising.
Oh, that one?
Oh, yeah.
And they took the blurb out of context. Which was
they did. It was awesome. I wrote the publisher. Was like, thanks for that ellipsis in the middle. That was pretty sweet. Anything.
That reminds me of the best documentary I ever saw yet could never write on it. I really liked Wordplay. and yet I can't sell people on it. It's like it's a movie about
the one about crosswords.
Yeah,
with Jon Stewart in it.
Yeah,
that's the best documentary you've ever seen.
That's the one I like the most. I can sit down and watch that constantly, just because I'm like every time.
John, have you ever seen the film by Earl Morris or Barbara Kopple or Alfred Maisels?
Oh wait, are those people dead or alive?
They're not Japanese.
But is Errol Morris the one who made the plane?
Oh. So you gotta, now when John says that's the best, my favorite documentary, now you need to know where he's coming from.
No, but seriously, I like that because I can turn myself off and just go, this is the saddest subculture that I know of. And I like
Did
it.
You see
that's
that?
That's the saddest subculture?
There are sadder subcultures.
Oh, my God.
I think Trekkies are...
What about that one about like the medieval siege reenactments or whatever?
Darkon. Or Second Life.
I didn't see Second Life.
Second Life is about the online avatars.
There's one in Second Life.
Yeah. I can send it to you.
We should point out, by the way, that Chris Marker's latest work is a Second Life avatar, which is highly enjoyable, I should say. You should search this out.
Okay,
French website, which I do not have the address
Chris
for.
It's beautiful.
I actually lied. My favorite documentaries are Kazuo Hara, just because... He gets himself beat up every time.
Hey, he's Japanese.
Oh my God. Wow. Really? When did you notice?
About the time you started watching his movies.
Until then, you thought he was European?
Yes, I'm Eurocentric.
I know. Well, I want to switch us off to another topic, one that I've got the first interest in, which is namely 1990s Much Music program.
Oh, yeah, we were emailing about this.
Like this, you may have asked for the joke. But,
So may I ask you, you're not from Canada.
Not at all.
So how on earth have you watched all of this stuff?
Because when I was in my teens, and I lived in D.C.
Like, you know who Master T is?
I know who Master T is. Okay. I know Matthew Good. I know Ed the Sock. I know George.
Who just got fired. That's a topical hook for this. Do you know
there
that
you
Ed
go.
The Sock, who's a Canadian
no
institution.
Way.
For the people who don't know, Ed the Sock is a rather profane, cutting pop culture pundit who's also a puppet. And he's been on City TV and Much Music for like 15 years. And he also has a late night show with his wife, who's a very funny and talented woman named Leanna Kirzner, who I've met a few times. And like that's basically like a softcore comedy review with like, you know, naked women and burlesque shows and whatever else. And at the stop, like, he's like Don Cherry. He's really important in Canada, and he's been fired. We were talking about this on the bus ride over.
Indeed,
so now we have a news hook for talking about the glory days
so
of Much
Music. Why did they fire him? What happened? Did they just
rate basically, Rogers has taken over City TV,
yeah.
I believe. So Rogers...
Rogers being a broadcasting giant in Canada,
yes.
Owned by Ted Rogers, who owns the
Sorry,
Blue
that's
Jays.
True. These are all just kind of like instant, you know, identification.
These are references from way up there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they've been bought out by a gigantic media conglomerate, and they've gone about shutting City TV, which was kind of Toronto's signature television station, prided itself on being local, prided itself on knowing everything about the city, now being more or less...
And on integrating smut into programming.
Which is, well, that's how that, which is how they got their legs going.
Yeah.
The immortal Baby Blue movies back in the late 70s, I believe.
Well, they also got their legs with music video programming because Much Music under the chum, that predates MTV. I say with some pride, I guess.
Well, way to go is there's now MTV Canada, too.
Yes.
I don't know how they actually compete. But, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, neither of them shows music videos.
Yeah, I remember Must jumped in when they started doing their DJ search, too, and they gave us Bradford Howe. You thankfully shipped down to America to be on VH1.
That's right. Do you remember Bradford Howe?
Yeah, really sort of like affable, like Brendan Fraser type. Sort of like not fat, but sort of thick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And very pleased with himself as well. You're welcome to him, by the way.
And Much Music also gave us Nardwar the Human Serviette.
Who's now
one of the great sustained pieces of media performance art, and who has given the best on-camera interviews with Snoop Dogg that anyone has. And that's not up for debate. They're brilliant.
See, I love the ones he's done with Rollins, where it's him and Henry Rollins, and
yes.
Henry Rollins is about to punch him out, and Nardwar is just like, how does it feel? What was the thing? Like, how does it feel that you've moved on?
Oh, I do remember reading about this, yeah.
From being like in a prolific punk band and now just doing spoken word. It's like, how does it feel to go from hitting boys and girls, and like now you're trying to be this? And Rollins is like, is this a joke? Are you joking with me? I'll tell you what, if you're joking, you stop right now. It's great, because Rollins is like flexing, and Nardwar is just happy, and he's got his microphone up there. And Nardwar, who also... Is he really still on tape now?
Pardon me?
They're on DVD now, that's why I read about it.
They were put out in Canada. And I had to review them once for my magazine. I sort of took a look at them. I mean, I figured I was just going to sort of, you know, flip through it and make a small mention. But I ended up watching the body of the 60-minute show, and, you know, he's pretty good. I mean, I don't want to compare him too much to a guy like Colbert, but what struck me as similar about them is that you have to sort of interview in character, so you have to measure your own reactions against, you know, the characters, and he never really broke it. Some people have argued that that's because he basically is that guy, but I find that hard to believe. I think he's pretty savvy.
Yeah, he's an interesting interviewer in that no one ever seems to catch on to him. Like, every time he does an interview...
Except for Snoop, who by the third time had the most fun I've ever seen him have on camera.
But it's just weird. How come no one's caught on to this? Like, you have American pop, like, American musicians, actors go on, talk to them. They're floored the first time. You have Canadian people do this, too, and they are similarly, like, out of bounds. I don't know why that is.
It's like... Maybe because as American movie stars and musicians, they could give a shit what's on Canadian television, but they have no idea. Maybe they really think that these are the sort of yokels who... are representative of downtown Toronto.
I really like it. Sometimes on the Onion Navy Club, like, these angry Canadians will show up in the comments.
Yeah.
And they'll start having, what is it? Like, first someone will say Nickelback, which is always fighting words. And then someone will say the New Pornography. And what's that one band that everyone adores over there that's, like, kind of a plodding rock act that's been going on for years and years?
Tragically Hip? Sloan?
Yes. Every time it always comes down to the Tragically Hip. Sloan I actually will get behind, but, like, the Tragically Hip just, like...
Well, but the reason you can get behind Sloan is that they never even came close. And that's not the only reason. I mean, they're a good band, but they never came close to breaking through in the States, so they're sort of a niche thing, whereas the Hip sort of strained rather unbecomingly towards trying to be successful in the U.S., and even though it never quite worked, the Jester was enough for some Canadians to get pretty sick of them. But none of our acts broke through in the late 90s. I mean, Our Lady Peace didn't.
Yeah,
I like Peace Guy. That was definitely like a middle school thing. I remember
what's
that.
What's the band that Adam McGuane loves so much? It's from
The Tragically Hip.
No.
Sarah Pauly covers in The Sweet Hereafter in one of the least moving moments ever.
Not The Tragically Hip. There's something else. There's another band that he loves.
I don't know that Adam McGuane likes pop music.
No. There is another band. Oh, huh? God. It's an era.
From the funny year he showed for Showbiz Parlance in Where the Truth Lies. You know,
No. But there's something in Ararat where it's a Canadian-Armenian band, I think.
You're asking me to remember Ararat. I don't remember.
See, I love Ararat.
I don't remember Ararat.
We tried to... All right, should we shift this to the eternally loved and hated topic of Adam McGoin?
No, right.
Okay, sure.
Does anybody care, like, south of the border? I don't know.
Who is that?
Not anymore.
There we go.
I think Ararat
is terrific. Quit the president. And I want to write a defense of it. Like,
Adam McGoin, our national institution.
Yes. I'm thinking of his name differently.
What's the name of that band?
Yeah, ATOM.
Yeah, no, correct.
I'm not sure. I mean, look, there's no question that Egoyan is one of the major Canadian filmmakers of the last 20 years, but then you have to start going film by film and ask why that is. I mean, I think a lot of the sort of the surveillance video, you know, that kind of self-reflexive trope stuff he was doing in the late 80s, I'll give him that he sort of gleaned onto that quicker than most other people did. And Exotic is pretty enjoyable. Pretty enjoyable little drama with kinky edges to it, but you know, The Sweet Hereafter never did it to me, and the last three, I think, have to varying degrees just been embarrassing.
We actually have an interesting situation right now, because he has a new film that just played at Open Con.
No, The Blindness Open Con.
This is my mistake.
Adoration showed at Con to very little response from
him. So it's kind of interesting, if you consider him interesting at all, that his last film, Where the Truth Lies, is clearly an attempt to break through and make a commercial hit. You know, while having some of his own, which it is, and there's no doubt about that. Yeah. But I mean, this is clearly some of this beckoning towards the American market, right? So we've got Kevin Bacon, we've got Colin Firth, we've got, you know, Adam McGoin doing commercial murder mystery, sex murder mystery kind of thing. And yet, apparently, the new film, which I haven't seen, I'll say right up front, is taking great pride in its localism, in as it's showing Toronto streets and highlighting Toronto landmarks and things like that. It's some sort of brave act. Now, I don't know.
I haven't seen the film.
Why is Don McKellar famous? I've never quite figured this out. Can you explain that one?
That's not quite fair. I mean, McKellar as an actor always had...
I saw him in a movie that I don't think anyone else saw, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was about, like, this reality show where
System
people...
System of a Down.
People,
Oh my God. Wait, you're kidding.
Canadian? I'm just saying...
They're not Canadian, no.
I'm just saying that's the band that he has referenced.
Yeah, we know.
Yeah, System is of a Armenian. Down or the Ararat of bands.
That's just because...
Okay, there you go. I just wish... I have no opinion one way or the other.
No, I'm glad System of a Down came into the... No, you said...
I can't remember that. I remember for some reason that the woman who made it is called Chris Lefko, and it was this really funny, vicious movie about people who didn't know they were being taped for a reality show to find the biggest loser on the planet, and McKellar kept saying snotty things the whole time, so that was funny. But aside from that, I have never figured out like exactly where he fits in.
There's a short film by Peter Lynch who just had a
I've actually seen one of his movies.
Which one?
Project Cyberman. I saw Cyberman.
And you haven't seen Project Grizzly.
I know,
you're
right?
You're running the gamut of major Canadian filmmakers.
No, because I was still living in Austin and played at South by Southwest, so I was like, oh, okay.
Because McKellar is in a film by Peter Lynch called Arrowhead, which is a really splendid little short film where McKellar plays this twitchy guy. Of course, that's what he does. He wrote a series called Twitch City, so he knows his own
limitations. And he wrote a big movie recently, didn't he?
Well, Blindness. But what I was saying about Arrowhead is, you know, he plays a guy who thinks he's living in an apartment on the Don Valley, and he thinks he's found a dinosaur bone in his backyard, which is something Lynch has returned to. That's the plot of Lynch's own film, Whale of a Tale, where Lynch really did find a dinosaur bone in the Toronto subway, a whale bone, and try and figure out why. And McKellar's kind of just been ringing variations on that for a long time, so it's someone who has a shtick, but he's pretty good at it. And if you watch most Canadian actors, just McKellar's got more going on behind his eyes than most of it.
You asked about him as a filmmaker, though.
Yeah, because I remember hearing about, because what was that movie he made about the last day on
last
the planet?
Last night.
And then that was, I think, the last thing I heard about him
Which is sort of a watchable, low-key...
David Cronenberg.
Apocalypse drama with David Cronenberg as a... I forget if he's an insurance salesman or whatever else, but calling all of his clients, you know, just to give them assurances, even though the world is ending. That movie was... that has former Miss Alexander Payne in it as well.
Sandra Oh.
I think that probably won 19 Genies. We only produce so many award-worthy films a year.
And I'm speaking from a very prejudiced position here, and one that I might not even be that informed about, which gives my opinion all the more... relevant.
On this podcast,
if you write on the internet.
Yes, exactly. But there's a very kind of comfortable middle ground of achievement and success in Canada for certain figures within there who can make a certain kind of film and be assured that they will be able to keep making films. When having a kind of illusion and a bit of illusion of ambition about it as well.
Can we not?
We'll get to
again,
him. We'll get to him in a minute. Sorry, go on.
No, and there's this aura of ambition about them, but say completely within very safe grounds. So it's really great from both an artistic perspective and a financial perspective. They don't have to strain that much artistically, and they're assured of continued funding because they're all we've got.
This explains Mike Myers so well.
He took leave of us a long time ago.
Myers is symptomatic of something that happens in Canada, which is when people are successful and stay in Canada. No. When they're successful and they stay in Canada, whatever level, we say, you're small fry, man. Why don't you make movies in the States? You go to the States and you're a sellout. There are very few people who've managed to, you know, remain beloved in Canada as filmmakers. With actors, it's easier. But with filmmakers, you know, there's still, like, lingering resentment over James Cameron. I mean, even though we never made a movie in Canada.
And is Cronenberg, like, the one who sort of straddled both, or is he...
We can't resent Cronenberg because he actually just keeps making... good to decent movies. If you resent him, the ship is
and lives scuffed. In Canada and makes Canadian co-productions.
Yeah.
And
gives work to Canadian gaffers.
he's become a national treasure more or less over the last. Sorry to go back to right the beginning of the discussion.
And he gives good interview about it. Yeah. You know, like for Eastern Promises last year, it's not a movie I particularly like. I had to interview him and. You ask him if the magazine I was writing was about the Canadian slaves. I asked him about it being a Canadian film, and he, you know, gave this answer that sounded to me really nice and off the top of his head. He's like, you know, I might not live here, but like Graham Greene said about England, you know, England made me and Canada made me. And I said, that's nice off the top of your head. That same quote shows up in 75 other interviews that he did. And I'm not criticizing him for it. It's just he knows what to say, and that doesn't strike me as disingenuous or whatever else. But he's at the end of the day, he makes good films, and that's why people still take him seriously. What I'd want to ask you guys as Americans is, so who have we talked about now? Cronenberg? Madden?
Goyen?
Peter Lynch came up.
What?
What, Don McKellar? No, that's fine. What else have you got if we ask you guys about Canadian films that have been made in the last 10 years?
I heard about Men Without Brooms, but I heard it was really bad.
Men with Brooms.
So, yeah, I heard that was not okay.
Which had Matthew Good?
They had hats.
The director of that, or the star of that, is now opening the Toronto Film Festival with a film called Passchendaele, which is a... You want to...
Oh, yes. Well, it's a mainstay of Canadian high school history. This is where many, many Canadians died in assault on a World War One ridge.
The director of
Men with Brooms is directing and starring in an epic drama about Passchendaele. Many Canadians will die.
Yeah. About which we can say nothing because we haven't seen the film.
Yeah, but we can say so much.
But so what else have you got?
Is it Degrassi Canadian? Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, God. See, when we're getting to Degrassi, this is bad.
Sorry. Because, yeah, that is Kevin Smith. But no,
there's also Andromeda.
I'd like to hear about, since I just gave you the DVD, Adam, on Uncle Antoine.
Well, I wouldn't want to use up all my material when I have to write it. But certainly Quebec, this is something, again, on the 11-hour bus ride, we had a lot of stuff to talk about in between, like, trying to sleep. You know, in Quebec, Quebec's different than the rest of English Canada, because in Quebec, not only have there been strong directors over the years, from Claude Jutra to Denis Arcand, even though Arcand's last movie was abominable. And, you know, straight through now to a filmmaker like Jean-Marc Vallée, who made a film called Crazy that was very good, and he has a very anticipated new film at TIFF. But in Quebec, they just, like, man up and make actual movies, like genre films, comedies. You know, it's, you know, sexy romantic films that don't tend to have like apocalyptic undertones or sad kinkiness in them. Like Quebec films aren't hung up about sex the way English Canadian films are, and they're not afraid of aesthetics the way that a lot of English Canadian films are.
From my perspective, I have very little knowledge of Canadian film, and I would love to get a perspective on it.
I remember, because I haven't made it to TIFF yet because I can't afford it, but I know a lot of people who do, and every year the long-standing suffering joke is, you know, what is the Canadian retro going to be? Haven't they actually just stopped doing it this year? Like, the
Canadian retro?
There's a Canadian sidebar, and there's also, like, a directorial...
Canadian retro stuff tends to be pretty strong.
And I think, apparently this year, they're just not doing it?
Well, they did one on Alan King, who I think, by any objective standard, is one of the great living filmmakers, to say nothing of just simply documentary. Because you guys know Fred Wiseman. King is his, you know, his contemporary, and you know... Canadian terms. Well, who have they done recently? They did Norman McLaren.
They brought down the McLaren Shorts to MoMA for like a week long run. So I didn't
see
those.
And the Anthology Film Archive shows Canadian films every year, right? There's always a selection.
They're having another program. I forget who, but another one of those. Like every time they show Canadian shorts, it's always the same thing. You know, they always ran on TV and they're widely beloved and
like
haven't been shown
the Log Riders Waltz. Did you ever see that one?
Involves log riders.
Yeah, Pleasing Girls by Burling Down White Water. If any Canadians are listening to this, they're having like overpowering sense memories of watching this stuff on YTV, and Americans have no idea what we're talking
about. Oh shit, that reminds me, Anti-Gravity Room. There we go.
I don't even know what that is.
Something on YTV.
Is it Japanese?
No, actually Canadian. But hosted by a
Japanese Canadian?
I think Chinese Canadian. Kim's from Vancouver, so.
Wasn't Everything's Gone Green? Wasn't that set in Vancouver?
It wasn't ever. That was adapted from a Douglas Copeland novel.
That was an original screenplay, and I think I'm the only person in the United States of America who sat down and watched it, because I was actually, like, I'm still into Copeland, because I thought he actually became a better writer since Generation X. And I watched it, and there was that whole thing about, like, the palm tree moving around, and, like, taking pride in, like, I think an all-Canadian soundtrack as well.
Yeah, a lot of hipster-approved... Canadian band.
Oh, I don't mind that. Did anyone actually? Because no one saw that.
I wrote about Everything That's Gone Green and interviewed the director Paul Fox, who started making a horror film. His first one was a horror film called Dark Hours. My friends who live in Vancouver assure me that Everything's Gone Green really captures the, you know, the city, for whatever that's worth for you.
That was just a weird thing, but it's not a weird Canadian thing. It was just there were two movies in the last 3 years that were the first original screenplays by like semi or major writers.
What are the other ones?
The other one was Game 6 by Don DeLillo, and both of which were just absolutely just like ignored, which was so weird to me.
I never saw Game 6.
Yeah, no one saw Game 6. It played for a week here with no advertising and then closed down.
What?
The Regal Union.
Really?
Yeah, it played for a week with no advertising, then went pretty much straight to DVD. I've watched it twice because it's pretty. If you like Don DeLillo, then you'll like Game 6. But I guess that wasn't a selling point.
We can move away from Canada if we've run out of.
We like it.
Run out of, we like didn't it. Really talk about much music. Maybe that's for the best.
Yeah, but I like the Canadian film thing because on one hand we have really no idea of it outside of those four or five main directors.
Yeah, that's true.
Which, you know, which isn't fair. And I have friends who program Canadian films. If they ever hear this, like, you know, they're just going to kill me. I'm not trying to be reductive. You've got to go on a film-by-film basis. Like, I'll toot my horn again. I've done this in print many times for a Canadian film called Six Figures, which I wrote about for CinemaScope by a director named David Christensen, which was a brilliant, sort of like vaguely Haneke-inflected, but not quite so sanctimonious.
Did he stop the film and rewind just
No, that's what I mean. I mean, stylistically, it was more, his model was Edward Yang, like lots of nice, open compositions.
It's the first time anyone but me has name-checked Edward Yang on this podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Edward Yang, Oliver Shalom, rest in peace. Of all the losses of people who I will never know and don't know personally in the last year, because you don't want to overstate these things, it just absolutely broke my heart.
I was pretty upset that day.
It's not fair that, I mean, how many, because they just did a retro of him in Toronto, which I imagine was in, I mean, how many films did Yang make?
Seven or eight. And he was going to make a Jackie Chan animated martial arts film.
Well, he'd been talking about that
something
for years. But yeah.
That was just like, because when they, I don't know what the retro was up here, but down here we only get the same shitty 16 prints over and over again of Terrorizer and Taipei Story.
But the print of Taipei Story was really quite good. The print of...
that would be nice to see.
The print of Mahjong was good. Miss Terrorizer's beautiful print of Brighter Summer Day.
Can you send it down here? Because they're literally, I heard about this from people who took NYU classes in the 90s. It's the same 16mm prints that were showing in this class.
Was it the 4-hour version?
Yep.
Yeah, which Godfrey Cheshire showed back in late 90s, which I attended it at the Museum of the Moving Image.
Yeah, I've seen a shitty VHS bootleg of that, which is like unreadable for an hour because of the white-on-white.
I can send you a VCD of it.
If it's any good, it's any good. Yeah.
We're talking about Edward Yang now. You missed all the good stuff, Andrew.
Oh, goodness.
Thank you.
Get your drinks over here. Let's get moving.
Edward Yang. Were here for McKellar, but now we're on Yang. No, what I was saying about Six Figures is, you know, it's this, you know, like really assured first feature by this very smart guy, documentary filmmaker David Christensen. Didn't get a bad review. When I passed it on to American critics and colleagues, they really liked it. And within Canada, it played for only a week because we're so... Now about Six Figures.
Yes.
Which Andrew liked as well. And because the cynicism that we are exuding here leads over to the point where people won't take individual movies on their own terms. So I'm trying to argue both sides here and say there are good films made in Canada, there are very good films made in Canada, and vital films, but in some ways we're just so conditioned to being dismissive that sometimes we miss them. No one who I showed Six Figures to didn't like it, but the fact that I had to show it to them and drag them kicking and screaming in the first place is the problem. Are you about to say you didn't like Six
Figures?
No,
now I remember that I saw a Canadian movie in the last year.
Which was
The Tracy Fragments, of course.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, I liked it for a number of reasons, but mostly because it made people walk out of a multiplex, which I almost never see happen.
But see, I like this reaction here of Tracy Fragments and then,
I said nothing. There's nothing on that microphone.
Unfortunately, that
I made a facial expression.
So let's.
And you haven't seen the movie.
I have not seen the movie. This
I thought it was because I saw it. It's like, and then I looked it up, and the guy had been working on Degrassi for a long time. Yeah. There's like no surprise here. It was like having a 16-year-old girl scream in your face for 90 minutes, which I, you know, find
interesting. Or it was like having a 40-year-old filmmaker's idea of what a 16-year-old screaming in your face.
It was my idea of like a Canadian film, because like the funniest thing to me in that is that there's a character called Lance from Toronto.
Yeah,
which struck me as interesting.
So why does it play for Dan Sleet so much?
Well, that's just because Dan's a formal nut, and it's.
Do you know Dan Sleet?
I know his writing, and you know what? Yeah. From a formalist point of view, it's sort of exciting within Canadian film, because we're talking about style being anathema, and there's no question
that
it's sort of audacious, but at the same time, this is a film that superimposes an actual horse over a character while Patti Smith's Horses plays in the background. We have not exactly gotten to a point now where this is like, you know, really like probably oblique adventurousness. It's pretty on the surface, and I think Ellen Page's performance in that film, even more than Juno, may be the ultimate Ellen Page performance, because like sort of brittle and vaguely unpleasant, yet she compels a lot of people. I mean, she's an actress who I find her impenetrable. I have to say.
I would argue that I could
Juno
probably
showed
find
she
her
was
not
penetrable. Yeah.
Zing!
But enough about my future sewer, maybe lesbian girlfriend.
Did you really like Juno?
No, I just read like Ellen Page.
Like by the fifth Moldy Peaches song, where you just
that was swimming? That was like congratulations on like ruining the Moldy Peaches. You know, it didn't actually take that much work to ruin the Moldy Peaches, but to remind me that some of their songs were actually unlistenable, and then to play all of those songs in a row,
like by Michael Cera's like an 18th adorably inverted self-conscious line reading was your heart just
no that's cool because he's only in five scenes of the movie and yeah. I saw Superbad twice so like I'm cool with him because he's the new John Cusack anyway but you know like
see I don't care because I never saw Juno.
Nice.
Can't wait until his war in
I can happily say that I love Ellen Page through not only X-Men 2 and X-Men 3 where they put her into skin tight leather and go here
hard candy
act but hard candy hard candy, candy is
hard candy is a movie that doesn't have the balls to have a real castration
hard candy is
in
one
it.
Of the funniest movies I've ever seen but it's not
what
supposed
movie
to be,
does
I
have
think.
A real castration
Flanders
oh god I saw that uh-huh. too
and you know what I awful. Said I think Hostel 2
yeah
Hostel
2, which is a deep and penetrating analysis on America's culture of torture. Fuck you, Eli Roth. I hate you.
Sorry. Hey, you know what I like?
I like the fact that we struck a nerve here.
Ah, sorry, I can't take it.
My favorite piece of Hostel 2 PR.
Let's talk about
was,
Ellen Ball. Next, but anyway. Yeah.
Well, if we want to talk about people we hate, we'll be here forever. Yeah. But we had this discussion in Toronto about Munich as well, which is when you tell me the things in Munich that honestly were foregrounded for you and that right. jumped out for you, I don't see that as disingenuous. They just weren't the things that were foregrounded for me.
Right.
I mean, for me, watching Munich, a lot of the strategies that struck you as successful struck me as really facile. But we've also had this discussion about Cachet heading the other direction, which is a movie that I, even though it's now becoming extremely hip to hate on Michael Haneke, this is now the new...
I hated him before it was cool.
That's fine. You hated Haneke, you know, I mean, with Haneke, it's going the other direction. Right, whereas for me, the things that I honestly foregrounded in Cachet were not the things for you. So I don't think that these are fundamentally incompatible approaches to film. I disagreed with your Indiana Jones review. I didn't think
it Actually, was, I haven't seen it yet, but I did hear this weird thing that I probably even shouldn't say. It's a friend of a friend of a friend, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, basically the sound substance of what I heard was that his wife forbids him to spend more than 6 hours on the set, which when you're making a movie like Crystal Skull could be kind of a problem. So I'm actually quite
Kate
willing...
Kate Capshaw?
Yeah, is that
Spielberg's wife?
Yeah, so I'm actually quite willing to believe that there's a little impersonality, but when I haven't seen it yet, but I can't imagine how that could be more personal.
I mean, like,
sometimes.
But,
I don't know.
But let's actually talk, rather than just sort of like hate it level, let's take parts of Crystal Skull apart. For
sure.
instance, you and Armin White and his review and a few very... I'm being really, really serious.
Oh, shit.
Talked about some of the imagery in the bomb test scene. Right?
Yes.
That you have the plastic house and that you know we've never seen Indiana Jones in a domestic space before, which I agree. I mean, Indiana Jones is not usually in places with roofs unless they're hundreds of feet high, so I'll give you that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, foregrounding Jones as this kind of loner character against this family, and then you know, in the fridge, which is sort of a you know palpable, you know, physical 50s symbol, and
right.
the bomb going off. So, you know, I get all that, and I don't think it's unconscious because Spielberg's putting it in there. On the other hand, it's hard to feel too much about that when it's just a set up for a punchline of him being scrubbed off. A mushroom cloud is only a potent symbol if you don't cut away from it half a second later as just another beat in your sort of like, you know, your slapstick action comedy. I felt that there was nothing in Crystal Skull that, there was certainly a lot of stuff in it, but none of it is, you know, affecting. It struck me as a sloppy, impatient movie, however interesting some of the visual ideas are in it, because his ideas visually are always interesting, even in movies that I think are entirely bad. Go on.
The potency of the symbol, I think, is enhanced and responded to by the UFO at the end of the movie, the climax of the movie. Because I believe that is taking two icons of the era that Spielberg is addressing, in a sense, the fear of destruction,
yep.
the space race, and bringing them together into, I guess you want to call it a pop cultural kind of... whole miasma, whatever you want to call it.
Bringing them together, but as they exist separately within the timeline.
But they exist separately realistically.
Because I didn't notice the similarity in framing. It may have eluded me.
Well, the similarity in framing is there because there's him on the right side of the atomic bomb, dwarfed by it. Now, an older Spielberg, I think, might have had him rising up...
Older in the sense of younger.
Older yeah. Spielberg in the sense of younger Spielberg would have had him rising up full face... dwarfing the atomic bomb. But what Spielberg does is he has Jones dwarfed by the atomic bomb. So the symbol, the icon, is dwarfed by the bomb.
Yeah.
Similarly, and he's on the right side of the frame. Similarly, when the UFO rises, he's on the left side of the frame, and also dwarfed by that. Hence, that is a mirror image.
Well, but here for me, and when you say this, part of me finds myself nodding along, and part of me, and this might be glib, is like, by the time the spaceship shows up, and the film has been reduced to this sort of blur of Industrial Light and Milhouse, whatever, with the 13 aliens and just the physics of the way that they act, I couldn't understand what was supposed to be going on, because the story, the particulars of the story, and the various errors in the story, like for example when they're all going down into the pit, and Spielberg goes to great trouble to show the stairs receding into the wall. And then a couple of minutes later, Blanchett and her people are just down there. Because the movie doesn't have the patience to sort of explain how that could possibly happen.
It happens because on the cliff, they use ropes to rappel down the cliff. Therefore, they use ropes to rappel down the side of the temple.
Is the temple repellable? Do we see them with the implements of their repelling? Yeah.
No, we don't. But I believe we can imply that. And why do we need to show it?
Little known fact, Nazis can fly.
Or, for instance, the people who are...
There is a central thing that they can tie ropes around and they can rappel down into the bottom. They can absolutely do that, and I got that the first time out.
You know, or the people who are hiding in the ceiling who attack them?
Yes.
I mean, do they breathe in there?
It's an effect, but here's the thing, Adam, nitpicky
is a perfect word for it. I don't nitpick when the particulars of a film are compelling and enjoyable.
So therefore, it was not compelling to you. How can we really have an argument about it?
Well, it's not an argument, it's a discussion.
No, we can have a discussion, but how can we have an argument? First of all, the point here is not to come to a place where we convert one or the other.
Essentially
to state our points of view as we see them. Now, you know, if that bothered you, there's nothing I could do about it.
If what bothered me? The repelling?
If it bothered you, if the repelling bothered you, if the people who are inside, you know, how did they breathe inside the tunnels in there bothered you, well, you know what? There's nothing I can say that's going to change that. And I don't say that pessimistically. I don't say that whatever. It's just that's the way it is. If it didn't work for you, it didn't work for you. But I'm serious. You know, if it doesn't work, where am I at? I mean, essentially, we're at an impasse.
Well, before we got into the nitpicky discussion about repelling, what I was saying is that it's a question of what's foregrounded for a particular critic while watching a film.
Right.
And so I think that, for me, I don't really bring in any baggage about Spielberg. I take, each film as it comes. So to me, some of the things that I'm looking for or not looking for in said film are not, it's not as readily apparent. I mean, what I saw sincerely while watching that film was sort of a superfluous, and to me, a movie with no stakes and no urgency at all, attempt to reignite a successful franchise, because at this point, that's what they have the money and the wherewithal and the summer release space to do.
And I think that there's more to it than that, and... I felt that on a first view. And I went into it having heard Matt's ecstatic reaction to it and being kind of skeptical of that.
Right.
Because of what I'd heard about it and what I'd read about it, too. I was pretty skeptical about it, about the Lucas tampering or whatever, this, that, the Darabont draft being not used and all that.
And Shyamalan wrote a draft.
And Shyamalan writing a draft. Everyone wrote a draft of it. But, my experience of it, and the three times I've seen it, and I've seen it three times, and I feel like I can speak confidently about it, is that it is a very deep and profound film to me. And not necessarily just for Spielberg, because I can go to the Spielberg stuff and say there are things I hate, or dislike, like Private Ryan, and like basically anything from like Lost World to Private Ryan is kind of like anathema for me. I hate the Terminal.
I like Jaws 4.
I really hate the Terminal. Jaws 4 is a special kind of masterpiece, but that's not Spielberg. But I don't necessarily go into it. I don't feel I go into it with Spielberg bias. Do I have my filmmaker biases? I admit that I have certain filmmaker biases.
We all will.
I think there's the Spielberg thing. There's like Iris Sachs, who I know Andrew and I had a very good conversation about Married Life in Toronto.
You know, and we came to different opinions on that, but I think we respected each other at the end of where we all ultimately ended up. So
if I can ask, to move it towards a larger...
Please do.
Do you have Vadim? Because you have to... Do you have filmmaker biases that are like... Just you can't overturn them, positive or negative. I prefer positive because it's easier to be negative than positive. For example, my favorite filmmaker is Claire Denis. Love Claire Denis, and I really like The Intruder, and I can say why after three viewings. But the first time I was watching it, what pushed me through and what carried me through, like Bart at Camp Krusty, was this unwavering feeling like it's okay, it's Claire Denis. If I work through this, it's going to be okay. And in the end, it was okay. And now again, I can say why I like that movie. I could go on about it for a long time, but that's what carried me through. And I think we have to, you know, admit that we do these things.
I think that's such a... There's a number of filmmakers that I adore, but I can't think of a filmmaker with a perfect track record for me. Even
not a perfect track record, but who's someone?
No, not even one. Like sometimes when I like. Like, I really like Linklater, but I think Waking Life is a big piece of shit. But if you want to go from an auteurist perspective, I can see exactly the things in Waking Life that come from a lot of his other movies. Mm-hmm. And I still just have, a visceral dislike of the movie.
But you don't do that pushing through thing?
Sometimes. Lately, I'm into Philippe Garrel, so whenever they show a Garrel movie here, we saw... La Lettre de la Vierge, an incredibly, and to me, I started laughing hysterically about half an hour into it, because it was just like the perfect unconscious example of like the pretentious, you know, art house 60s movie.
You didn't laugh in the very first scene when she hands him a megaphone?
Oh yeah, but there were things about it that were just obviously, to me, stupid, but I'm starting to enjoy Garrel so much that like I was just like, go to it, my lad, you know, do whatever you need to do. But yeah, even Spielberg, I'm probably as big a Spielberg fan as he is, even more so obviously since I just said I like The Terminal, but I can't work up any kind of enthusiasm over like Catch Me If You Can. So I can't, yeah. At a certain point, I just kind of tune out sometimes, no matter how much I like filmmakers.
Do you think that there's, since we all have filmmakers that we're devoted to for whatever reasons, do you think there's just some people, and I'm not naming any names here at all, do you think, though, there's some people that we just need to go to bat for every time, irrespective?
Oh, definitely can.
Yeah.
Even De Palma. I was thinking De Palma's another test case because, you know, I've seen Femme Fatale three times, but if you really want me to talk nice things about the Black Dahlia, then...
Well, what about you, Charlie? No, we're not.
We've expanded the discussion.
As you've heard Vadim reference my Japanese love affair before, I have two. Kitano and Mika.
Okay.
You want to talk about Glory to the Filmmaker?
Oh, can we?
Whoa.
I would love to.
Do it.
That is a movie. What did Christoph, you write about that in CinemaScope? It's the film of a free man. Doesn't mean that I can bear it.
Has any filmmaker taken a more precipitous decline in world critical stock in the space of 5 years?
But he's done it on his own. But he's done it on his own terms. It's fascinating. We watched that together, John, the filmmaker.
I can think of one, and actually I liked him more after he turned. It was Lucas Moodysson, because I really didn't care for the kind of soppy together
thing.
But
did you like A Hole in My Heart?
Yes,
At that point,
I was like, hey, I'm with you now.
And a sweet movie.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was adorable, but my friend...
We interrupted John. Mika and Kitano.
Yeah, the two Takashis.
Yeah.
I mean, mainly because I think Kitano has realized what he's done. There's a critical series of essays a while ago called Takashi Kitano versus Pete Takashi.
Oh, yeah, we had the book by Cassio LeBay.
Which is kind of fascinating, at times a little infuriating, because Cassio begins doing these, equals Kitano plus this minus X.
I think that might have something to do with the translation as well.
No,
frankly,
I actually asked my back when I was in college, I asked my teacher about it. And he went, no, that's how Cassio wrote it.
That's even more unfortunate.
Which is sad. I was like, this makes no fucking sense. Aside from parts where he accurately describes Kitano as a television, as a product of television and of Japanese
his
television.
His televisual body, as I recall, is the terminology. Yes.
And as he is processed into media, he splits into the director and the beat. Which, I mean, for...
That's why I don't read academic film criticism.
Trust me, Japanese shit gets even worse.
Going back to school this fall.
Nope, I graduate.
That's what you are.
Did we have any more on Indiana Jones, though, or what?
I think
no, because ultimately you're right. You're correct. Not that it's a good movie. but that we're not going to ever have...
Well, I am correct on that. Well, anyway.
There you go, and that's why you're right, because we're not going to... You know, we're not going to convert each other. I
love you, boys.
I think that... But in the case of Indiana Jones, it's just that, because for me, and this is something that I just might be wrong about, but my back goes up when things that I see as clearly product get investigated. But maybe that's not fair, because there are a lot of extremely successful... mainstream films that have things to be excavated from.
Do you feel that there's anything that has been viewed by product as anyone else that you have seen something worth it?
Stealth. Stealth is one of the best American films of the last 10 years. No, I'm
this
joking.
Is one of those times. Yeah.
No, but I'm serious. Right. I mean, come on. Can you...
Crank.
Crank's really good.
Crank had a lot of defenders. I remember that.
That's true.
Are you not one of them?
I haven't seen it.
But it was a slow build.
I'll go to bat for Transporter, too.
I'll go to bat for Revolver.
But it was like a slow build of defenders for that, actually.
But look, Crank's not really at the same class as Indiana Jones. I mean, Crank is a nasty,
You mean like kind of monolithic blockbusters that actually...
Let's talk about Wall-E. I mean, has anyone seen it?
I still haven't seen it.
Okay, we can't talk
so
about it.
I'm really excited.
Let me bring up my second director then that I always defend. Mieke.
Okay.
Look at Mieke in terms of had international success for the most part for Audition.
Yep.
Then came to fame for Ichi the Killer. That's Over the Top. And after that...
With Katana, of course.
No,
Ichi the Killer.
Katana
no,
was in Izo.
Izo, sorry. Yeah.
And then look at what Mieke produced after that. Graveyard of Honor, a remake of a Fukusaka film.
That's a disingenuous. Let's talk about the Great Yokai War, which I don't remember meeting a single person who liked.
Oh, Great Yokai War, which was a remake of an earlier film, Japanese Monsters or something Monsters.
Yeah, a children's TV series.
Mieke is one of the filmmakers, and I think we might all have some of these as well.
Who
filmmakers who I don't hate, but who I'm quite content to live apart from,
I'm
and to not need to see
like every fifth movie that he makes. Like I'm not
precisely, and I've seen my small share. I've seen Fudo. I've seen Audition. I've seen Dead or Alive. And Mieke is somebody who I admire in an abstract way, and by abstract I mean disconnected from any of my own feelings or inclinations.
But he's
I don't need him around. But he's somebody who I don't mind other people saying good things about.
And you know who that is for me is Philip Carell.
Ooh, who we talked about while you were
there. Right. Yeah. Which I may have given a mistaken impression on. All his films so far has made me want to kill myself. Which is not to say that I don't see their artistry, and I'm very excited for the new one that Karina and Glenn have championed extravagantly.
On this podcast.
On this very podcast. I forget the name of it. Vadim, do you remember?
I can't remember either, actually.
Oh, it's the newest The Frontier of Dawn.
Yes.
Yes.
The Frontier.
The title
film.
Alone just makes me want to like weep salty
tears. It's kind of like
manly tears.
Manly tears.
That I got to see both that and Savage Grace at Sarasota Film Festival, which is basically populated by a lot of retirees, and that essentially both films gave precipitous walkout. Like precipitous walkout. Like when have you seen Savage Grace?
I just wrote about it this week.
When the scene. Yeah. And Savage Grace hits.
In Sarasota, that
precipitated
open
revolt.
I walked out on Savage Grace at home.
You walked out on Savage Grace?
I walked out on Savage Grace at home, and even though I finished the movie mentally, I walked out.
Okay.
Nothing that happened in the last half hour of that movie impacted me at all, because my brain was somewhere else. I watched it because I had to.
Okay.
Savage Grace.
No.
So wait, before we actually get to the end here, I need to bring this point
an end?
Up.
Oh, no.
Yeah, there is an end.
I have to bring it up right now. Much music. Let's go back to a topic that I really like, and actually I championed this artist for a long time.
This is going to be awesome. Here we go.
A too long time, as far as I can
recall. Matthew Good.
Why did you champion that artist?
To annoy me, primarily, I think.
Did it work?
Yes.
Okay, what's the best Matthew Good band single?
Generation X-Wing.
Generation X-Wing?
Yeah.
I've not heard that.
It's off Reagan.
In the City of Silver.
What about Hello Time Bomb? Why are we talking about Matthew Good?
Because
we're talking about We Own the Night over here, which is
because
far better.
Again, Bondi, right?
Because every week we talk, literally every week since we've started, we talk about James Gray and We
That's true. We've talked about James. You know, and it takes a lot to make me hate a movie where my name is pronounced correctly and often as a character. And yeah.
Let's jump back to James Gray, because on one hand,
James Gray's a guy I pull for. We're talking about those filmmakers.
Yeah,
but I love him because he's made, from what I know, for Wheel of the Night, for The Yards. Haven't seen the most recent one yet.
Two Lovers.
Which will be coming.
Everyone is the same. And I love that about it. I can watch The Yards, and then I can go watch Wheel of the Night and go, hey, these films are the same until this point, and the same until this point. I like that.
Similar yet different.
I kind of like watching the same film over and over again with Joaquin Phoenix every time.
Yeah, that's kind of like all the Japanese cult movies you watch.
No, again, well, you know, this is... Speaking of the people we go to bat for all the time, I mean, James Gray is somebody who I do go to bat for.
He's your cause.
Yes, indeed.
If you can't afford moving to France, you might consider Quebec in that case.
Yeah, or Shyamalan.
It's great.
I was there until I can't bring myself to watch The Happening, but I was there for Lady in the Water.
Let Andrew finish about Gray, and then we can end on The Happening.
But, you know, it's... I'm sorry. I didn't know that. Apparently, he was talked about every week here. And this is something I wrote a long article on him for CinemaScope, and I actually got to know him after that. So we actually correspond quite a bit. So we've become sort of friendly, even though we've never met in person. So of course, when Wheel of the Night comes around, there's a lot of, and this happens, I think, to a lot of critics, especially people far more elevated than I am or anybody else.
Sure.
When you start, you know, commiserating with filmmakers and hanging around with them, it's hard to get any kind of perspective on their work sometimes.
Well, I would say, though, that it gives another kind of perspective, that if you're willing to sort of engage with that...
But sometimes it's a worrying perspective.
It can be worrying, but I feel like... I don't know, if the intelligence of the argument is there, nonetheless, sometimes knowing the person actually is helpful. Sure. Yeah, and I'm not, you know, I understand the ethical things and everything. I know Mike D'Angelo, for example, has, I think, some ideas about that, which I totally understand as
Nonsense.
Far as, like, knowing.
Mike D'Angelo is not the white arm in white. What are you saying?
I was trying to be nice there.
Oh, I'm sorry, he's also straight. So.
But...
So much of this isn't airing.
No, this will air, but
anyway,
no one ever listens to this point.
I'm just saying...
I'm just saying that...
Sometimes I think knowing a filmmaker actually can help towards the critical dialogue.
That's kind of like the ultimate altruism, in a way.
No, but, I mean, you know, it depends. Can it be abused? Sure. A lot of things can be abused.
We're probably going to do a whole podcast about this at some point, because this has kept coming up a lot.
But at the same time, you know, it depends on the critic. It depends on how they write about something. It depends on how they approach it. You know, if you say you know, Andrew, if you say you know James Gray after, you know, just before We on the Night came out, I think that's what you were saying.
Yeah.
You know, I still felt like the piece that I read, that you wrote on it, was, you know, a very measured piece of criticism. And I mean, it feels like that perspective can be used, too. And I mean, I don't think that that's something to be avoided. If anything, I would say it's something that is important, because I think that a lot of critics don't have a knowledge of filmmaking in some ways that would help them to inform their criticism on how they react to something. You know, it's kind of like, it is the extremes of, is it good, is it bad, is it this or that, or something like that. You know, whereas I think knowing a filmmaker in some ways, and maybe this is one of the reasons I like Paul Schrader so much, for example, not all his films, but some of his films anyway.
You know
that,
Paul Schrader?
I'm just saying, he treads a critical and a filmmaker's perspective.
Yeah.
And he's talked about this in his own commentaries, too, about how those two different perspectives are different, but not necessarily antithetical, that they can't commingle in some ways. You know, that's the only thing I'm saying, is that I feel like it's not something that should necessarily be discouraged, but it is certainly something that needs to be... God, I'm going to quote Spider-Man... With great power comes great responsibility.
And who has the great power here?
Well,
none of us.
On that note,
we
exactly.
do. Well, we do.
Oh no, let's stop this.
No,
right
no, no.
Now.
We do. We have. Cool. We have a power. Critics have a power that I know. I'm not talking about like power to influence necessarily.
I have the power to get drunk by myself at home and watch
Indeed.
National Treasure
but,
too.
But I'm just trying to say a power to express ourselves in the most intelligent, passionate, honest way possible.
Which is getting drunk from watching National Treasure.
That don't undercut what he said.
That can be yes, I know. There are people who do that, and there are people who can get drunk and do that, and that's totally them. It's just like, you know, I feel like what I'd like to see more critics doing is to get out and be more social in their environment, in the environment that they're trying, in the environment that they're writing about.
We can all agree.
Yeah.
That critics should be
social in general.
Socially, but also intelligently. In other words, that yes, you can get to know filmmakers. Like, could I write a negative review about an Irish sax film, for example? I feel like I could.
Well, can we write a pointing critical review about Preston?
No. I feel like I could.
This is the guy who made this film Jones that I've never seen.
Yeah.
We've had
drinks with him and everything. I feel like I could. Would it be hard? Absolutely. It would be extremely difficult.
This has never come up, but there's definitely going to be a point in which I'm going to recuse myself.
But at the same time, I feel like with Preston, there would be a point at which I would probably recuse myself from reviewing something of his that I wouldn't like, but I feel like I could talk to him and I could say to him what I didn't like about something, or I could talk to him about why I didn't like his film. I feel like I could do that.
I would bring up one thing quickly, which is that, I mean, you do talk about, and I think you're right in saying that there is a certain advantage for a critic in, you know, being acquainted with the filmmaker and being able to talk to them and understand them. But the funny thing is, even with some filmmakers who are very much acquainted with film history and, like, the past that they're drawing upon, the thing is, their profession puts them in a very different position than it does us.
Yes.
For instance, I mean, from my own extremely limited personal experience, so talking to James Gray, for instance, who knows his film history, but you know what? He's a professional filmmaker. He writes scripts as well. He doesn't have time to see a lot of movies. So basically, he's still referencing things that he saw in a very formative period. Yes. He doesn't have time to see a lot of things that we now do and to be influenced by them as well. So the things that he's drawing on are formed from a very earlier, you know, period in his own kind of development.
Yes. Yes.
Whereas we're keeping up with, we try to keep up with, I think.
Well, we have
yes.
to.
Yeah, exactly.
Although I would put as a counter argument, and I don't know him personally.
That's not even a negative.
I'm just saying as a counter filmmaker, it's a different example. Jonathan Demme, for example, who I've met and I've talked to a few times, was at Tropical Malady. And he makes a point of it to go to a lot of newer films, for example. I would even argue, despite the dislike, that I believe Quentin Tarantino does it well. He has a different perspective from, I think, what you guys do.
I'm sure he does.
But I'm just saying, there are examples of filmmakers also who keep up, you know, with Preston as well. And you still might not like what they take from that and put into their own movies. You know, and I get that. You know, I mean, it's just like that's... I don't want to say opinion, because I think opinion implies something that's not necessarily thought over and intelligent, but just like a really thought over opinion, a thought over reaction.
I just
because there is the passionate reaction, and there's the sort of.
What you were saying, I remember this was kind of like a moment for me when I realized that I watched too many movies, and this was going to keep going on. When I was still growing up in Austin and going to South by Southwest every year, and they had a Linklater on Jarmusch panel. Or like where they were talking to each other, and Jarmusch said this thing that I think struck a lot of people as really weird but made complete sense to me. He said, you know, these days I don't get to see as many movies as I'd really like. I only get to see about 3 or 4 a week. And the average person is sitting back going like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And it's like, I know exactly what you're saying. Like, if I was only watching 3 or 4 a week, you have to think about this 3 or 4 carefully, because especially living here, or I guess you guys have Toronto, so I assume that there's a pretty healthy slate of stuff.
So, if you live here,
it's like 3 or 4 movies a week, you'd have to think pretty carefully about those.
So it's sort of comparable to what our own personal experience is, I guess is what I say.
I like that. That's a good
thing. Yeah. Yeah. And,
I think on that note, you can...
The last thing we should do is everyone should say their favorite scene from The Happening.
I haven't seen it. Okay,
The Happening...
Like, just favorite scenes. We're not passing judgment on the movie. Just what is the best part of The Happening?
My favorite scene that I... Just from the trailer, because I haven't bothered to go watch it either. Guys, the bees are dying. Does no one care?
I'm really upset because I spent all this time telling people that Lady in the Water is actually good, which I still believe. And then the two other guys, literally the two other guys on the planet I know who defend Lady in the Water, Tully and Theo Panagiotis, who I adore in Cyprus, couldn't get behind the happening, and they were with me on Lady in the Water. It's like, well, that's it. You know, I'm done.
I hope I don't steal yours.
You probably will, but that's
As a large percentage of people off themselves in a field, Zooey Deschanel. We can't just stand by here like uninvolved bystanders.
Yep, that's up there.
That was a line of dialogue from the film.
Correct my, I haven't seen it, but my understanding is this is the third straight Iraq allegory that he's made.
Yeah. Well, I could actually cite a favorite moment to that end, but for me, when I think back on the happening, the most fondness for me be in a scene where I have two words for everyone, which is lion cage. Anyone who's seen it knows what I'm talking about.
Yes,
and
yes.
Anyone who hasn't
Gorgeous.
Seen it, that is why you must. You must see the happening. Because you have one of the, and I'll stick my neck out here a bit too, because up until The Village, I defended Shyamalan a lot. You have someone who has created some of the better, like, tense sort of horror film sequences of the last 10 years, even up to including The Village, like that bit of business with Phoenix and Adrian Brody and the knife, which is just a superbly put together little bit. For that guy to turn around and make that lion cage scene, I got nothing. So if you haven't seen the lion cage scene, go see the happening. Buttress, it's $60 million gross. He needs you, or he's not going to be able to make movies in this budget range anymore. Go now.
As Mark Wahlberg said in the press conference about most of the scenes when he was being directed in The Happening, and Knight was saying, "What were you thinking about during those scenes?" And Wahlberg said, "Jesus, baby."
And on that note, episode 17, Canadian film is X-rated.
No. Episode 17 is Robert Rodriguez equals Guy Maddin.
Oh, better. So episode 17, Robert Rodriguez equals Guy Maddin, X plus sign. Just to give a nod to our good friend Cassio. I'm John Lipton, joined by Vadim Rizov.
My number is 512-517-4689. If you made it to the end of this, you really need to get out more.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But please call Vadim and chide him first. Or invite him to karaoke and pretend you'll sleep with him.
That always works.
Because he will do it.
He will. Yeah. And as always, edited and curated and moderated
edited.
livenly hosted with Keith Ulick.
Thank you.
Special guests Andrew and Adam.
Andrew Tracy and Adam Naiman.
And we're both very pleased to be here. Thanks very much.
The reputations of whose first names clearly precede them all the way into.
Well,
New York.
It's either that, or when I do the write up, I'm just going to have the Andrew quote Tracy unquote fragments.
Thanks, guys.
It was
really fun.
Brilliant.
Yeah, we're done. Thank you. Good night. And if you see either of us at the bar, except for the Canadians, please buy us a drink.